Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
You're listening to Washington Post Live's First Look podcast with Jonathan Capehart.
Welcome to First Look, Washington Post Live's one-stop shop for news and analysis. I'm Jonathan Capehart, associate editor at The Washington Post. Well, this has been a big week for the Supreme Court and its newest justice, Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson. Here to talk about it is The Washington Post Supreme Court correspondent Robert Barnes. Bob, welcome back to First Look.
Nice to see you, Jonathan.
You too. So the new term began on Monday. And on Tuesday, the justices heard oral arguments in a voting rights case out of Alabama that will have major implications for the Voting Rights Act of 1965. What exactly is this case about?
Well, this is about Alabama's congressional districts. And as you know, all states have to redraw them after the census. Alabama has a voting population of about 27% African American. But when it redrew its maps, only one of its seven districts were drawn so that a candidate of color would likely emerge. That's the way it's been for decades now in Alabama. And that was challenged by a group that said there should be at least two such districts. A lower court agreed with them unanimously, involving two judges appointed by Donald Trump. And now the Supreme Court is taking up the case to look at when states have to make room for minority, so-called majority-minority districts.
Right. This is a case that revolves around race. And I'm wondering, Bob, what impact will Justice Jackson's disquisition on the race-conscious drafting of the 14th Amendment, which is really an originalist argument, what will that have on the ultimate decision, do you think?
Hard to know. The conservatives on the court have not been very friendly to the Voting Rights Act, as Justice Kagan brought out during oral arguments. But it was interesting to me, the three liberal justices really sort of worked as a team to try to defend the Voting Rights Act against what Justice Kagan had said had been conservative attacks. Justice Jackson, as you mentioned, brought up this idea that perhaps the Constitution really isn't colorblind, that the 14th Amendment and act and federal law such as the Voting Rights Act were there to protect minorities. And so race is a part of this, and it shouldn't be completely excluded from these kinds of decisions.
You totally took the next question I was going to ask you, which was about the three liberal justices and their reasoning in this case. Let's talk about another case that's going to be coming up on the Supreme Court docket, and that involves affirmative action, one centered on Harvard, the other centered on the University of North Carolina. What are the arguments in each?
Yeah, are you sensing that race is going to be a big part of the Supreme Court term this year?
Yeah.
Because it is. And this is, once again, the court considering whether or not universities can use race as one factor in deciding their student bodies and who they should admit. There's a challenge to Harvard's practices. There's a challenge to the practices at the University of North Carolina, so a private school and a public school. The court for decades now has said that, yes, race can be used as a factor, not quotas or seats can't be held in a class for a specific race, but that race can be part of the calculation. But this is a new court, a more conservative court. And so once again, the issue is here. I think that it looks probably worse for those who favor the use of race in college admissions than it did before, because the court is more conservative. And the justices who have upheld this in the past largely are gone.
Yeah, the court is more conservative. It's this, there's a 6-3 conservative majority on the Supreme Court now. Another case, Bob, that the Supreme Court's going to hear weighs the role of the that state legislatures can play in federal elections. What might the impact be on future elections?
Well, the Constitution says that state legislatures are in charge of administering basically federal elections unless Congress steps in and makes its own choices. And so the question is, when the Constitution says state legislature, does it mean only the legislature, or is it talking more broadly about the states? And the question here is whether state courts have a role in this. State courts have played a big role in deciding when election practices violate the state constitutions. And so we have seen we've seen redistricting plans struck down in some states where they were done by Republicans, North Carolina, for instance, and Pennsylvania, and by Democrats, New York and Maryland, for instance. And so this is about whether those state courts will have a role in that. They always have. And so it would be a huge change in the way federal elections are administered if the Supreme Court says, no, whatever the legislature says, whatever rules it sets, that's it, and it's not reviewable.
Bob, let's switch gears and talk about Donald Trump and those purloined documents that the government took from Mar-a-Lago. Donald Trump has asked the Supreme Court to intervene in that classified documents case. What's he asking the high court to do?
Well, it's really a pretty limited question that he has presented to the court. There are two parts of an order that came down. One about a special master being able to look at these documents and decide, you know, are they really classified, or some of them personal records that are his? So that's one thing. The appeals court also said that the Department of Justice can continue a criminal investigation and use the documents that were seized. Trump is not contesting whether or not the Justice Department investigation can go on. He is contesting the part of the 11th Circuit's order that said the special master shouldn't look at these documents and do his own review. And it's a very technical question about whether the appeals court acted too quickly. And so even if former president prevails at the Supreme Court on this, the legal experts I've talked to said that it's not going to be a huge win, or it won't really affect the investigation very much.
Bob, there's a story on the front page of the New York Times today, and I'm wondering if you have the same reporting. It says the Justice Department is said to believe Trump has more documents, meaning more documents that he was supposed to turn over after a couple of subpoenas and then that search, and still hasn't turned them over. Will a story like that have any impact or play any role into either the case as it's, you know, with Judge Cannon is her name, or with this a question from Donald Trump to the Supreme Court asking them to intervene?
Right. I don't think it would have anything to do with what the Supreme Court is looking at right now, because, as I said, it's a pretty technical question about the special master that the Florida judge appointed. But certainly it could have some effect on those proceedings in Florida, which are ongoing and, you know, are sort of just getting started in a way. Now, the Justice Department has asked the 11th Circuit to sort of expedite its consideration of what the Florida judge has done. And so, you know, this investigation, these documents, all of this reporting is sort of going on in separate tracks. But I don't think that would affect what's currently at the Supreme Court.
And in the little time that we have left, Bob, I still, in this whole the story of Mar-a-Lago, the classified documents, Trump taking them from the White House, they're actually U.S. government property. Shouldn't we keep that as sort of the North Star here? that these are documents that don't belong to the former president. They are documents that belong to the United States government.
Yes, but I do think that part of this suit is about, are they really documents that, I mean, they belong to the government, but are there personal things in there? There have been some reports that said some things were sort of inadvertently seized, and that's what happens when the FBI goes in and does one of these searches. You know, they sometimes gather up more than they should, but the Justice Department says they've already had someone go through and look at that. I mean, you know, the former president is pretty litigious. He likes to file lawsuits. Sometimes they're successful. A lot of times they're not. But, you know, it's all part of the sort of boil about this and the former president. And what he says is, you know, sort of unfair treatment by the current administration. It's a little hard to separate the politics from the legal issues sometimes.
You know what? That is truth, Bob. Bob Barnes, Supreme Court correspondent for The Washington Post. Thank you for coming back to First Look. Have a great weekend.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We're going to keep the conversation going with the Opinions Roundtable in just a moment. Let's go to the opinion side of the Washington Post, where we will find Washington Post columnists Eugene Robinson and George Will. Gene and George, welcome back to First Look.
Glad to be with you.
Good to be here, Jonathan.
All right. So I was going to start with Supreme Court, but I want to start with the brand new jobs numbers and unemployment numbers, just to get a quick take on what it might mean for the administration. For the midterms, 263,000 jobs created in September. Unemployment rate fell to 3.5%. George, what do you make of this?
We're in a very peculiar economy in which we are, by standard definition, in or close to a recession, yet unemployment is very low. Whether or not we're heading for something like stagflation, I don't know. But I don't think this is going to affect the midterms, because the American people don't take their sense of economic well-being from Bureau of Labor Department statistics, but from a stroll down the aisle of a grocery store, or a pause at the gas tank where they have the interesting experience of a $100 fill-up. So politically, I think it's negligible.
Mm-hmm. Gene?
I would agree with George. I don't think people, you know, are like us and eagerly awaiting the numbers and to see what the number is. And, you know, stock market traders are. I think the markets are a bit down now, but I don't think that's the way people mm-hmm. are experienced, you know, the economy and make their decision on who they're going to vote for in the midterm.
All right, let's talk about Supreme Court. Gene, how conservative is this court, and how will that inform its eventual rulings on cases like voting rights and affirmative action? Because as Bob said in the last segment, race is a huge part of this court's docket.
Yeah, I think, and this court is very, very, very conservative. One of the big skeptics about affirmative action is Chief Justice John Roberts, who is what passes for a moderate or swing vote on this court. Not that that even makes a difference anymore, since even without him, there's a 5-judge, very conservative majority. So I look ahead in sorrow and some anger at what I think is likely to happen in this term on those cases involving voting rights. I think we may well see what is left of this landmark legislation that made such a huge difference in the lives of me and of my family. Mm-hmm. In South Carolina, I think we'll see the most of the rest of this act, go the way of the dinosaurs. I mean, it'll be invalidated, and I think we'll see what's left of affirmative action. I think under serious attack, I don't know if a shred of it will be saved.
Mm-hmm. Let's keep talking about the Voting Rights Act, because and the Alabama case, because liberals usually don't like the originalist argument used by conservatives in court cases, but Justice Jackson used it to great effect in the Alabama case. I thought I'm dying to know what you think.
Well, I think she's resting an awful lot on a thin reed, which is the existence of the Freedmen's Bureau Act in the 1860s, that because legislation was passed at that time contemporaneous with the enactment of the 14th Amendment, therefore race-conscious policies are generally acceptable. I don't think that's too much weight to put on the Freedmen's Act. And I think if people really want to get into the weeds about the 14th Amendment, they should read a book by Randy Barnett and a co-author published by Harvard last year, and just really comprehensive history of that. But it is fanciful to think that we are ever going to get an end to arguments and litigation about race-conscious policies. It just goes so much against, some of us believe, the American creed, that we're going to litigate and fight over this. Now, with regard to the case of affirmative action in higher education admissions, hysteria being the default position of Americans this time, next June, when the court rules on this, there will be hysteria obscuring the following. I don't know if Jean agrees with this or not. No matter what the court says, it won't make a particle of difference. It's one particular to the way universities behave. That is, the one exception is this: if they strike down, they say you cannot have racial considerations in admissions, this will accelerate the already galloping trend in academia to do away with SATs and general standardized tests, period, because they will do that. And then they'll say, well, we're gauging each admission on a holistic, that's the magic word, a holistic evaluation. And therefore, what the court says will simply not matter. Universities are going to do
it. The floor is yours. Oh, sorry, George, were you still talking? I'm sorry.
Oh, no, fine. I want to hear from Gene.
Okay. Sorry about that, George.
Oh, I do think what the court says will matter. I think it will make a difference to African American students or would-be students across the country. That said, I do believe that universities will seek ways around an adverse ruling to ensure something that they see as a good for all of their students, which is having a diverse student body. And whether or not the court says that is a reasonable goal for universities to have, I believe a lot of university administrators will continue to believe that's a good thing for all their students, and they'll, you know, they're pretty clever people, so they will seek ways around it. But they'll be handicapped, they'll be hamstrung in a way that they're not now.
All I know is about that holistic approach. I am glad Carleton College used the holistic approach in the 80s when looking at me, because my SAT scores were, I hated those do or die standardized tests. Let's talk about the midterms. And we can't talk about the midterms without talking about Herschel Walker. The Daily Beast published a story quoting a woman who claims the pro-life Republican candidate for U.S. Senate from Georgia paid for her abortion in 2009. A subsequent report came out with more quotes from her, including that she already has a child by Walker. Meanwhile, the candidate has denied these claims. Let's listen.
It's sort of like everyone is anonymous or everyone is leaking and they want you to confess to something you have no clue about. But it just shows how desperate they are right now. They see me as a big threat. And I know that. And I knew it when I got into this race. But they don't realize that. I think they came for the wrong one. They energized me.
He's talking about anonymous and everyone is leaking. One of those people who has been outspoken since the publication of the Daily Beast story is his own son, Christian Walker. Yeah. So, Gene, you go first. Can Walker survive this? And what does this entire spectacle say about the Republican Party? I want you both to answer those questions. Gene first.
Well, look, I think recent history shows us that any politician can survive anything. So, yes, it's possible that he survives this, but it's certainly also true that I think it damages him, if not with the hardcore MAGA base, certainly with independents, with more loosely attached Republicans who pay attention and who care about having a reasonable, truthful, intelligent person representing them in the United States Senate. And all those people logically are going to vote for Warnock as opposed to Walker. But I'm not ruling anything out, because what it says about the Republican Party is what we've been saying for years now. It is a cult. It is a cult of personality around Donald Trump, and Herschel Walker is Donald Trump's candidate, and the party, at least nominally and with dollars now, is all in on Herschel Walker.
George.
Well, we are technically in year 22 AD, 2022 AD. Actually, we're in year six politically of PAHT. That is the sixth year after post Access Hollywood tape. The Access Hollywood tape came out on election eve, and to put it mildly, did not derail the star of the Access Hollywood tape. Which meant that a lot of people, including what are called the religious right or evangelical Christians or whatever, they said, we'd rather win than have an exemplary role model to win with. So the question is, what difference will this make? Well, it's a tight race in Georgia, and therefore, if it has any negative effect, it's apt to have a large effect, even under the control of the United States Senate. But surely the most stunning fact about this is that it will, if it has a small effect, that will be all the effect it has. And that tells us much about the strange role that the religious right now plays.
Very strange.
In a little bit of time, Gene, did you want to add something else?
No, I was just saying it's a very strange role. It really is. I mean, these are, that's a whole show. We can do on the religious right.
Oh, yeah, it sure is. I remember those folks lecturing me about a whole lot of stuff that they now seem to ignore. But now let's talk about Russia, its war in Ukraine, and comments made by President Biden last night in New York, where he said that, quote, Armageddon, the risk of Armageddon is the highest it's been since 62, the Cuban Missile Crisis. I would love for both of you to talk about that. Is the president being hyperbolic? Is he saying the quiet part out loud? Should we take Vladimir Putin's nuclear saber rattling seriously, George?
I think the president's right. I think the president has been a failure about most things, but he's been brilliant about the most important thing. He and Blinken have been wonderful about Ukraine. And what they're trying to do is to win delicately. Now, it's hard to do that in a war, but that's what they're trying to do without pushing Putin to an irrational crossing of the nuclear threshold. I believe, and I've just read Max Hastings' wonderful book, Abyss, A New History of the Cuban Missile Crisis. Having read that, I am convinced that we are today closer to the first use of nuclear weapons since Nagasaki than we were in October, 60 Octobers ago in 1962. Because Khrushchev, for all his faults, and they were legion, was not irrational. And there are sound reasons to believe or to worry that Mr. Putin is increasingly panicked, desperate, inflamed, and irrational.
Wow. Gene.
Yeah. No, I mean, that is sobering coming from George, whose reading of history is often distressingly accurate. There's another big difference, which is that Khrushchev was not isolated. He was surrounded by the Soviet apparat. And so it was more of a collective sort of decision making process that allowed sobriety and careful thought, and within that context, dissenting voices. And Putin is isolated, apparently talking only to a few, decreasing number of people in his inner circle, and may not be entirely rational. So I'm really worried. I think President Biden was just speaking truth, we have not seen anything like this, certainly since the Cuban Missile Crisis and maybe since Nagasaki.
George, you wrote in a column this week that the United States needs to get more sophisticated weaponry to Ukraine immediately. What exactly do you want to see? Sophisticated drones, other types of weaponry?
Yes, we've already seen that our most sophisticated artillery, rockets and all the rest, with long range and extraordinary precision, have made a huge difference, killing, among other things, lots of senior Russian officers because these can target command centers. Next would be drones that make artillery all the more effective because they can, the Russian artillery can fire and can be fired back at almost instantly with intelligence provided by surveillance drones. This goes to the problem of, to use the phrase I used a moment ago, winning delicately. You want to win, you want to get them out, not just back, if possible, to the February 24th beginning of the war, but out of the portions of Ukraine that Russia had effectively occupied before that. The difficult decision that Biden and Blinken have to make is, at what point are you not delicate in the use of force? I think within the parameters of delicacy, drones of this sort are permissible.
Gene, what do you make of that? Should the United States, do you agree with George?
Mm-hmm. I agree, and I certainly agree with his construction about winning delicately. I think the red line that Biden and Blinken have drawn is, and Lloyd Austin, by the way, the defense secretary, who's and General Milley, they're deeply involved in these weapons decisions. And what they don't want to do is give Ukraine weapons that can attack deep inside Russia. Deep inside what everyone agrees and recognizes as Russian territory. And I think they'll continue to hold that line. But yes, by all means, should supply the Ukrainians with weapons that fall short of that, and that allow them to do whatever they can within the borders of Ukraine as it's internationally recognized, some of which Russia now occupies.
Okay, we've got less than a minute left, but I can't let you go without asking just a yes or no answer here. Yesterday, President Biden announced that he was pardoning everyone who had been convicted of federal marijuana conviction, federal marijuana charges. Good idea, bad idea. Gene, good idea, bad idea.
I think it's fine. I think the country is in the process of decriminalizing marijuana. This is a relatively small step. It affects a few thousand people. Simple possession on federal charges. I think we're heading in that direction.
George?
Yeah, I agree, particularly because, as I understand it, Mr. Biden is dealing with a small set of people who are in prison because of mere possession.
Right,
not distribution, and that matters. So the answer is yes.
No. Gene Robinson, George Will, and George, may I say, I am totally grooving on the tailoring of your blazer. I'm going to have to get in touch with you to find out need that because I really do like it.
Pass it at L and 18th Street.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Well, thank you. Thank you all for watching Fashion Talk. Gene Robinson, George Will, thank you as always. Thank you both very much for coming to First Look. Have a good weekend.
You too.
You too, Jonathan.
Thanks for listening. To always stay up to date with the series, subscribe to Washington Post Live's First Look on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.